Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for being here for the finale of CWA 2018. What a week it's been, and I thank you all for being here. I want to remind you about a special event that's happening because it's our 70th anniversary. After this, you can go to the Hill on 14th Street at 13th Street and Broadway in Pennsylvania. There is a new pedestrian mall there with lights and action, free food, music. So come celebrate with us on the Hill after this wonderful panel. So I want to tell you that I have been working on this, getting this group here for about 3 years. I would keep emailing them and say, are you finished with your film yet? What's going on with the Molly Ivins film? And finally they said, well, it's not really done, but we've got a few clips we can show you. So this is like a preview of the Molly Ivins film that they've been putting together that's called Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. So you'll be seeing about 20 minutes of the film that Janice and Carlisle are putting together, and we're hoping that maybe next year we'll have the film together.
Everybody cross your hands.
So I have a little business to do here, which I'm sure you're all used to because you've been here all week, I know. We're going to use both the app and note cards, yes? So if you have access to the app on your phone or computer, do text in your questions. We will have questions at the end. And if you are not facile with that, we will have note cards, and you can write your questions on note cards, and we'll get them up to Ellen. So Ellen is going to... Sweets is our wonderful regular at CWA, and I'm going to kick it over to you, Ellen, to introduce this wonderful show.
Thank you. Thank you, Betsy. Good afternoon, and if you're here for the special showing of Black Panther, you're in the wrong place. I want to introduce you to Janice Engel, who is the producer-director for the Molly Ivins documentary, and Carlisle Vanderfort, her co-director, producer, her co-producer. This has been one of those wonderful works in progress that we're all waiting to see a bit of. So I'm not going to take a lot of time going on about what Molly's wonderful rapier wit and how much we miss her now and how much we wish she was here. I'm going to let Janice talk instead. Tell us a little bit about how this came to be, how the two of you came to work together.
Hi, all y'all, as they say in Texas. My Texas producing partner, my co-pilot, has taught me to speak Texan. This came together in around 2012. Around this time, we have another producing partner named James Egan. He's not with us today. He's back in Los Angeles. He came up to me and had been wanting for us to make a film together, a documentary, and he said, do you know who Molly Ivins is? And I said, yeah, I think I do. Now, I grew up in New York and then in L.A., so I wasn't part of her constituency because I grew up on the left coast and the left coast. So I said, yeah, I do, but what's up? And he said, well, there's a play right now called Red Hat Patriot, The Kick-Ass Wit of Molly Ivins with Kathleen Turner. You need to go see it. So it was the closing week. I bought a ticket. I went. I said, I was knocked out by more about the material than at that point Kathleen's performance. We ended up seeing it again, and it was better. But it was, I just was like, wow, she's amazing. And so I called up James. I said, I loved Molly, and I loved the story they went for in the play. And he said, well, I want you to meet the playwright. Now, there are two sisters, the twin sisters, the Engel sisters. My last name is Engel, too, and we all spell it the same way. So, which means angel in several languages. We met. We had a love fest. Figured we probably came from some shtetl somewhere. And she loved us, and she said, well, you need to talk to Betsy Moon, Molly's chief of staff. So we put in a call to Betsy, James and I, and our big thing was, has anything ever been done? They said, no, there's never been a documentary, there's never been a film, and we don't want her to go into obscurity. She needs to be known. She needs to be known like Mark Twain is known. So we reached out. Betsy checked us out and basically said, we're on, let's talk about it. Now, during this time, James and I'm from New York. James is from Baltimore. He's a Catholic. I'm a Jew. What do we know about Texas? So we said, we need an authentic Texan, and we both at the same moment looked at each other and said, Carlisle Vandervoort. She deserves this. So we've been friends for 30 years, and she's known James for maybe that even that long. And I called her up, and I said, are you interested? And she said, what did I say? Jump in.
I was gang pressed. It was basically, you can't say no to us, but you have 24 hours to say yes. So I called back and I said, of course I want to do this, y'all.
Also, here's the thing. Carlisle grew up in the same neighborhood as Molly Ivins. Carlisle also went to the same private prep school as Molly Ivins. Carlisle had a parallel universe to Molly Ivins. So there were no mistakes. So we got all of us on board. We reached out to Betsy. The door was open. We got green-lit like within 2 or 3 weeks by Molly's estate, which is the Texas Observer and the ACLU, via her agent, Dan Green. And Carl, I was on a plane to Texas 3 weeks later, having done very fast research, and we got our first six interviews. And the door opened. Molly's posse welcomed us with open arms. And it's just been, here we are 5.5 years later, a labor of love, a passion project, a Herculean task. We have access to all her papers at the Briscoe. It is a journey. And we had every step along the way has been amazing. Actually, that first trip to Texas was our first fundraiser? No, that was our first shoot. Once I put footage together, so then we went 3 months later, we went to Washington, D.C., and we got three more interviews with her editor, Anthony Zerker, Kathleen Turner, who was at the arena doing Red Hot Patriot, and Myra McPherson. From that, I put together in the next 6 to 8 months what you're going to see today, a funding cut. That's just one of the things you're going to see. And it served us well. We went back to Texas, and it was longer. Now it's shorter. But we went back, and we did our first fundraiser at the Church of Hightower in Jim Hightower's office in a church. And we raised our first $17,000, and we were off and running.
Yeah.
So that's how it started.
And are we going to see a little bit of what you came up with in that time?
Yes. So we can show you right now. We're going to show you some things, and then we're going to talk. So is everybody good with that? We like to bring you along in our process.
Wait, I want to say something. Go. Is there anybody in the audience, and just holler, that doesn't know who Molly is? Okay, so we're at the Church of Molly Ivins. So because we're a church, afterwards, as the producer of the film, I want you to go out and preach the gospel of Molly Ivins to the younger group, because they need to know who she is, and you'll see why in the course of this presentation.
Just to let you know, this funding cut was made with the first 7 or 8 interviews. Of course, mushroomed from there, and we, in 2015, did an enormously successful Kickstarter campaign. Some of you knew about it. Some of you are on our social media. We have over 20,000 people following us. We tapped into Molly's constituency, and we raised over $120,000 from 1,600-plus contributors, and it keeps going. So that allowed us to shoot more interviews. Now we have 45 interviews. So let's show the first clip. Thank you.
All right, I have come to cheer y'all up about the state politics in this great nation. know you are in need of cheer. I know you think that it is looking dark and gloomy. You know, cheer up, it could always be worse. You could be living in Texas.
I am not anti-gun. I am pro-knife.
She had an unerring instinct to go for humor on every occasion.
We came into this year facing an embarrassing situation. The state of Texas is totally out of step with the rest of the world again. We had more people killed the year before by firearms than were killed in automobile accidents.
Oh.
That's pretty embarrassing even for Texas. So the legislature was thinking about how to change this around, and they decided to raise the speed limit to
embarrassing bad politicians is great sport.
What's your take on Newt?
You speak of the draft-dodging, dope-smoking, deadbeat dad who divorced his dying wife?
On the Democratic side, the race came down, as you may recall, to Bill Clinton, who never inhaled, and Jerry Brown, who never exhaled.
I believe that it's fair game when these guys stand up and say something foolish to lay it right out there and let people get a good look at what they have elected.
We got an issue in America. Too many good docs are getting out of business. Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
I accidentally became an authority on George W. Bush. Kind of like the guy who climbed Everest. It was there.
There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
I've known him since we were in high school. I covered him for 6 years as governor of Texas, and think how amazed I was when he became president.
Molly saw that, and when we started to do Shrub, work on Shrub, the first book we did on George W. Bush, Molly understood that this was going to metastasize, that Texas politics were going to become the politics of the nation, which I think is, by and large, true.
Well, I was the editor and founder of the Texas Observer, which, to be a liberal in Texas at that time, was far worse than being a communist or a child molester.
See, Duggar finally broke the sex barrier and hired both Kay and Molly to run the Observer.
My first initial impression was that Molly is huge. I'm very small, and she was 6 feet and large boned and just a giant personality.
The two of them together, of course, it really was a Mutt and Jeff operation.
Ronnie had let two women in their early 20s edit the only liberal publication in the state and one of the only few in the United States.
I went to cover the opening day of the Texas legislature, and I just fell in love with it. I thought it was the funniest thing I had ever seen in my life. It was the greatest show on earth. And furthermore, they were messing around with real people's lives.
Molly, one, she was trilingual. She spoke Smith College English, she spoke fluent French, and she talked Texan. And the Texan she got, she really appropriated it from these gargoyles who were running the state, all men.
When I first started writing about these bozos, and I'd say something in the Texas Observer like, you know, Representative so-and-so runs on all fours and has the IQ of an adolescent pissant. And I'd wait for him to come by with a horse whip, and all that ever happened was I'd see him in the Capitol the next day, and they'd say, baby, you put my name in your paper.
People, you know, sort of relished being lambasted by Molly. If she wrote about you, it meant that you were worth writing about.
She broke ground unquestionably. There was this far-right guy. He loved Molly Ivins. He just was crazy about Molly Ivins, and that's how she could reach people that would totally disagree with her.
Texas Observed. The reason the sky is bigger here is because there aren't any trees. The reason folks here eat grits is because they got no taste. Cowboys mostly stink, and it's hot. Oh, God, it is hot. Texas is a mosaic of cultures which overlap in several parts of the state and form layers, with the darker layers on the bottom. The cultures are Black, Chicano, Southern, Freak, Suburban, and Shit Kicker. Shit Kicker is dominant.
Molly knew that in order to run with the guys, she was going to have to be one of the boys. You had to be easy, you had to laugh, you had to drink.
She would stand up belly to belly with them and drink beer as long as they could. Made it much more easy for her to be part of the good old boy network and clubs. And I think particularly, Molly reveled in knowing the secrets of the club.
She knew how power was organized in the state because she grew up in the community where power lived in Texas, in River Oaks.
Yeah, my old man was in the oil business, and real right wing.
Truly, her father, you know, was oil and gas money, corporate money, and of course, white male Texan, God help us.
Molly swears that, and she had heard in her living room discussions about how to fix the oil market.
I mean, she says, I hate his world, he hates mine.
By then, Molly's dad was president for Tenneco Inc.
So she brought that to this much more populist critique of politics in the state of Texas, which is a state that is run by bullies, bankers, and bastards.
It may be that my politics are the result of some teenage rebellion that's just lasted for 35 years. But I suspect that they started, and this is true of most other liberals, with race.
We both grew up in a time of segregation. I went all the way through high school in segregated schools.
And the thing about growing up in the South, anywhere in the South before the Civil Rights Movement, was that you sooner or later became aware that grown-ups were lying to you.
Wait a minute, there are all these Black people over here, but they don't go to our school, and they can't go to the swimming pool, and they can't go here.
I remember being told not to drink out of that fountain, dear. It's dirty. Well, we lived on the white side of town. And the white fountain was always covered with chewing gum and little kids' grubby paws marks. And the colored fountain was clearly the cleaner fountain. And as I grew older, my first political involvement was in the Civil Rights Movement.
Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn.
The East Texas Civil Rights Movement, and call it Nobody Famous Ever Came. Martin Luther King never came. Stokely never came. Freedom Riders never came. CBS never came. God damn. It was just a bunch of uppity niggers and a couple of local communists. And it was always hot and we were always scared and there was nothing glamorous about it. And I never look back on that with any of the sort of nostalgic romanticism. I mean, I was so scared I wet my pants every time I got arrested.
Our next guest is one of the most outspoken political columnists in the nation today, and we have a collection of her writing. It can be found in this just-published book entitled Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She? Are you beloved by the folks who read the paper, or is it split right down the middle? Some hate you, some love you. How does that go?
They do polls every year that to find out who's the best liked and most hated columnist in the area. I'm always both.
Molly knew that humor is the door key to the brain. You know, you've got to unlock that little door for people to be able to hear you. And she did it with humor in just a brilliant way.
Dan Quayle.
There's been a feeling that the press has unfairly stereotyped him and really not given him a chance. I must tell you honestly, I traveled with him during the 88 campaign. I found him dumber than advertised. But I honestly think if you put that man's brain in a bumblebee, it would fly backwards.
Comedians had humor, and then they sometimes had politics. But Molly had politics that she delivered with humor.
I think the question is whether or not people in public office are screwing the public. I don't care who they screw in private.
Molly was a populist in the good sense of the word, and to be a voice for those who didn't have a voice.
What everybody was thinking that they wanted to say, Molly said it.
I tell you frankly, American politics at this point is corrupt.
What we have is a system of legalized bribery.
Corporations are people, my friend. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people. Where do you think it goes?
Well, the oldest thing in politics, of course, is you got to dance with them what brung you. And these people get elected to public office. None of them go into public life to, you know, become whores. But the fact is they can't get elected without special interest money. And when they get in office, they dance with them what brung them. They vote with the people who gave them the money.
Everything Molly said then, but we can repeat now, is absolutely true.
One of the mistakes we make when we try to talk about politics in this country is we keep pretending that the political spectrum runs from right to left. It doesn't. It runs from top to bottom.
You're supposed to be able to make it to the top, you know, if you work hard enough and you're committed enough, but it's an absolute farce.
We live in a country where the richest 1% of the people in this nation control 40% of the total wealth. And those numbers get worse every year.
That is a disgrace.
It's like the rich are getting richer, and the poor is remaining the same, and the middle class gets nothing.
I know that many of you are cynical about and disgusted with the American political system. And I am not about to tell you that that is a foolish attitude. This is a very brief civics lecture, and it really doesn't hurt at all. We are collectively the heirs to the most magnificent political legacy any people has ever received.
We believe that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That governments are instituted among men to secure these rights, and that whenever any government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. Those words are so profoundly revolutionary that more than 200 years later, they echo all over the world, and people are willing to give their lives for a chance to live under that system.
Politics in this country is not something that is done by them. It's not those people in Washington. It's not those people in your state capital. This country is run by us. It is our deal.
We run this country. We are the board of directors. We own it. They're just the people we have hired to drive the bus for a while.
She evoked a kind of response from people, a really beloved response from people that she was trying to reach. And, yeah, she got hate mail and she got horrible people not liking her.
I think of you as a hateful, lying left liberal. And the thing that scares me about you is people actually listen to you.
But that was to be expected. And I'm sure it didn't bother her. The payoff was the other way around. Hearing from these people.
Are the American people just so stupid that it is beyond hope? I mean, what is the story?
I never blame the people. And in fact, I think the American people have a great deal more common sense than almost all politicians, and certainly than all political consultants ever give them credit for.
The legendary journalist and author Molly Ivins has died after a 7-year fight with breast cancer. Molly Ivins dead tonight at age 62.
After Molly died, I began to get phone calls. And there was one common theme in all these messages that I got after Molly's death. Two times a week, in Missoula, Montana, or in some other small town, Molly Ivins made me feel like I was not crazy. You know, I'm isolated by geography, among political extremists, and what I believe is ridiculed. But twice a week, I read Molly's column, and I realized that, no, I wasn't crazy. You know, writers are lucky if they have readers. Molly was beyond fortunate because she didn't have readers. She had constituents all over the country.
I bring to you our own Molly Ivins.
I just want to urge you all, as you get out there and free to fight and raise hell about various issues, have a good time while you're fighting for freedom. First of all, we don't always win, and it might get to be the only fun you'll ever have. And second of all, it's a better way to live.
You know what Larry Goodwin once said, the country is lonely. I felt like the country was lonely when they lost Molly.
I think the big question that everybody is probably asking these days, what would Molly say today when you have the former governor of Texas, for example, running the Department of Energy, he who has resides in the back pocket of the oil and gas industry and has contempt for energy conservation, or a Scott Pruitt, or a Betsy DeVos?
She would be having a feast. And I have a feeling she would have mastered Twitter. We get asked that all the time. So this, just so you guys know, this is a rough cut. This was a funding tool. This is not masters. This is not pristine. It is what I put together in my little home editing. And that's the way it's been going. So we have done a lot more work since then. The mountain of interviews that we went through, and we have brought some other things to show that we wanted to let you know that, yes, so basically, as I said, we raised about over $120,000 in 2015 that allowed us to go on the road and film more people, including Dan Rather, Cecile Richards, Rachel Maddow, Paul Krugman, Victor Navasky, Paul Begala, Pete in Texas, Lieutenant Governor Ben Barnes, in his former residence at the governor's mansion at State Capitol, Pete Laney, a few politicians, and many friends, including Ellen Sweets. And in fact, also Molly's sister and her brother Andy, who it was incredible. We've been trying to get him for a year. We got him 3 weeks before he passed away, also of cancer. An amazing interview. So all that process then took me about a year and a half to cull this mountain of material down to selects, and then further selects based on Molly's life, themes. You're only seeing the tip of the iceberg here. And we've also been invited by Molly's papers are housed at the Dolph Briscoe Center for American Studies at UT. And Executive Director Don Carlton loves this project, and he wants to house the documentary. And so he has helped us by giving us money by purchasing interviews that will eventually also be as part of the collection, the entire film. So all of this is to say that I was finally able to bring on somebody else to help me edit this, because I am way too close. I can't see the forest for the trees, so I have an incredible editor named Monique Zavistovsky, who's come on board, and we are working feverishly to deliver a rough cut in June to then be able to go on and find our finishing funds. Our goal is to have this done for fourth quarter 2018, and I should say that the great Kate Amend, two-time Academy Award, Peabody winner, Sundance Board of Governors of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is also our supervising editor. We have an amazing team.
Well, I know that all of you are interested in hearing more from them, but we're interested in hearing from you too. So we have a question, and either of you can take it, and that is whether or not there will be footage of Molly from CWA that will appear in the film.
Well, that was one of my tasks, was to try and find the CWA footage. Did you want to answer that?
No.
Okay. So a producer does a bunch of things, and so that was one of the things I was doing. And at the time, CWA had not mastered the art of transferring film to digital. But now that we're here, I'm going to check in with somebody, I hope, before we leave or I leave, and find out if there is any footage from Molly at the CWA that has good video and audio. Because what I looked at a couple of years ago was not the best quality that we would want to put in the film to do her justice.
Also, I want to ask all of you, when you came to see Molly, how many of you used to come and see Molly here? Just give me a clap. Clap. Okay. Do any of you have home movie footage of Molly? Intimate. I mean, I'm just saying, out of the context, that is the stuff I have been looking for years. So if anybody has footage, you have any great photos, and would like to offer them towards this project, I would be thrilled, and so would Carlisle and James and Monique, to receive whatever you have. We are always on the search.
Thanks. I have a question, but instead of questions from me, let's take this one. Every person has strengths and weaknesses. Does the documentary also discuss Molly's weaknesses?
Well, yes, we do. And in fact, we have a surprise. So we have something to show. So I brought two other clips. So here's the thing. This is a project that's been taking long. Normal average for a documentary is 7 years. So we're 5.5 years. We're in good stead. I have one that is about the threat to the First Amendment and the Fourth Estate, since we are living in these times. That is the thesis. Yes, we don't want this to be a normal biopic. It's a bigger picture. There is a real threat to our democracy, and Molly was all about that. So we have about a five and a half minute selects that Monique put together, particularly. It's new footage, new people. And then we have something that she just sent me specifically. And we're going to show that. So, guys, I'm going to show the last one next. And it is it's the secret side of Molly that a lot of you may have known about but didn't really know about. And Molly was an alcoholic. I think a lot of you knew that. And there are things you're going to see in this. And this is what I would call a rough assembly. There's very little B-roll. There's no music. It's talking heads. It is a work in progress, but it is real meat and real gut. So let's roll it.
We're all dressed up to go to some event, and I don't know what it was, at River Oaks Country Club. And I think we were in our late 20s. Molly looked fabulous, regal and stately, but really very pretty and very lovely that night. And I was having my gin and tonic or something, and I said, "Molly, why aren't you drinking?" She said, "I'm an alcoholic." I said, "You are?" I was really shocked because it just didn't occur to me at all. Later, it became very obvious to me that she was. So she was very aware from an early age that she had a drinking issue.
First, we came from a heavily drinking family. My parents had cocktails every night.
Well, Molly never described her parents as alcoholics, but she did describe to me a routine in which her father would come home and they'd have a couple of martinis and then the sniping would start.
We were just kind of schooled that alcohol was something you did. And so she did that, and why, you know, maybe she had the genes or whatever it is that grabbed and made her become an alcoholic, but I mean, she definitely was a alcoholic.
Alcohol permeates every political venue in the state. I mean, it doesn't matter what party you are or anything, other than the Baptists who didn't drink or play cards. Alcohol was ubiquitous.
Alcohol was kind of the lubricating fluid of Texas politics. And if you were going to get anything done back then, you were probably going to get it done over drinks. And if you were on the journalism end of it, if you were going to find out what really happened, you were probably going to find out over those drinks.
Alcohol was a professional tool for Molly, initially. You know, a woman who could walk into Schultz Garden and sit there and drink as long as Bob Bullock or Babe Schwartz, another state senator, could. That woman was a woman to be contended with. And those men began to see her as a good old girl, as one of them. Bob Bullock once talked of, you know, this old girl who sat there at Schultz Garden and outdrank him. And got up and walked away with the story.
I think for Molly, drinking was a way of coping with the pressure and the intensity of her increasing popularity. It was what got her to a place where she could be comfortable.
You could tell it took a strain on her. There were times when I have lunch with her and she, you know, she didn't look good. You know, she was battling cancer plus smoking plus drinking. I mean, you know, I would talk with Betsy and we would say, you know, this is not a healthy lifestyle and, you know, something's going to have to give.
Molly started drinking more and telling me that she was drinking less, but she was drinking alone and apparently drinking and crying and very miserable.
Molly's entree into professional politics, the professional tool that sort of unlocked the temple for her, became something of a curse, and she knew that.
She would go out to fancy places in California every January, and she would clean her up her act. You know, she'd quit smoking, she'd quit drinking, she would lose weight, she would eat healthy food, she would be absolutely detoxed in every regard, and she would come back to Austin, and usually by April or so, things would start to fall apart.
Molly, you've had a fair share of loss this year. Some surrogate parents like Ida Frankel and your own mother a couple months ago. Those losses must have hit you pretty hard.
I've been to shrinks in my lifetime because I'm clearly not in touch with my emotions, and it's like you're supposed to be in touch with your emotions. And I would say on the whole that after that little run of people dying there, one right after the other, sometimes it's really nice not to be in touch with your emotions. You just need to not hear from them.
Molly seldom talked about her feelings. And she pushed the feelings away. And I think that's why the alcohol was such a part of her, was part of pushing it away.
Her nephew, Dax, had committed suicide. And I was staying with her in the hotel room. And that was one time I saw her drinking just to get to oblivion. Even then, she didn't cry, but she was very, very upset and with good reason.
There was an event in July of 2005, and it was an A-list event of people, from politicians from around the country. And Molly got astoundingly drunk, and she encountered Nancy Pelosi. And had a bit of advice for Nancy Pelosi, which I think was good advice, which was, you need a speech coach. You need to lower it a few registers because you have a tendency to sound shrill. Probably something that should have been said in private.
Molly was just an alcoholic of the worst sort, as I am. She had what I have and what all alcoholics have, which is a combination of terrible self-esteem and a raging ego. And we both found ways to shape that into a persona that pleased everybody to be around, and that was endlessly interesting.
So on the way home that night, Molly insisted that we stop and buy a six-pack of beer. And no one in the car wanted to do it. And she walked in and bought the beer herself, and she drank them on the way home. Waco to Austin is 99 miles. At which point, I felt like, as a friend, I had to do something. So I thought about an intervention, and I called Molly's then secretary, Betsy Moon. Then I called our agent, Dan Green, and together we decided on that there needed to be an intervention. I then called Ann Richards, who was a lifetime drunk, as she described herself, but a sober alcoholic.
My name is Ann Richards, and I'm an alcoholic.
Did you discover that you had a problem with alcohol by yourself? Did you wake up one day and
say, Oh, no.
I'm in trouble?
No. We had what was called an intervention where all my friends sat in a circle. And it's very carefully planned where they tell you exactly what you did. And then they end up by saying, and I know you would not have done that if you'd not been drinking. I feel so much affection and love that they would put themselves on the line like that for me. Yeah, it's tough. It's traumatic.
Ann said to me, I've been out of the drug business for a long time, but I've got contacts in that world, and I'm going to get you the best help in the city, the best counselor in the city to do this, and I kind of think you can't pay for this, so I'll cover it. And Ann called back and said, I've seen you work before, and you can be a weak-kneed man. She said, this is a whole lot harder than standing up at a press conference and asking a question of the governor of Texas. And when you reach that door, your legs are going to be shaking. But she said, you walk through that door because you're saving your friend's life. And then we did the intervention. And that was in It was in the summer of 2005, in July or late July, early August 2005. Molly knew what it was when we walked in. It was five of her friends, and she said, "I know no one's died. Looks like we're having an intervention here." And she eagerly went into rehab. It was something for which she was waiting to happen.
She did a 30-day program, did not ever drink or smoke cigarettes the rest of her time. She said to me when she came back, "You don't know how close I was to the final fuck it." That was in August of 2005, and in November is when the cancer returned.
A couple years before she died, she called me, and I guess Lou had done an intervention, and she was done. And she wanted to spend however many years or months she had left getting to know who she really was and what her life was, what the deepest meaning of her life really was, what was true that she could take with her on this journey of probably getting really sick again eventually and dying. And I pushed back my sleeves. I said, "I'm in, let's go." Molly did the hardest work that any human can do, and she did it while facing her own death. She faced the deepest truth of her life. She faced the deepest wounds of her life. She started peeling back the layers of the onion, and it was very, very hard because she was also extremely scared about the cancer. It was probably the scariest possible time for her to get sober, was when she was facing her own mortality, but she wanted to face it the way she faced everything, which was with her head high and her eyes open.
Very quickly, I want to let the audience know that there are people standing by with cards in case you have questions that you want to raise. If you raise your hand, someone will bring a card to you. I want to ask you both, was there anything else that you discovered about Molly that you didn't know, that you didn't expect to find?
Well, definitely that she got sober in the last 18 months of her life was amazing to find out. That is one of the most courageous things that any human being can ever do. You know, Molly spoke truth to power, and she was fearless. She went after people, but she couldn't face her own stuff. And finally, you're dying. Most people would say, "Fuck it. Let me just go out in a blaze of glory." She wanted to know herself. I think that was, to me, the most amazing thing I found out about her. And that's why I wanted you guys to see this clip.
What about you, fellow Texan?
I have to go with getting sober also. That was a really amazing thing, which, I mean, I knew she'd gotten sober because I'd read her biography. But to the interview with Annie Lamott was very eye-opening. Very, very eye-opening. Which is the woman in the interview, if y'all don't know who that is, with the white woman with the white dreads.
Annie Lamott, who lives in Northern California.
They were close.
Became her sponsor.
Yeah. That's technically not known, but yes, I believe so.
Oh.
Don't tell anyone we told you.
We'll keep it among ourselves. One of the things that maybe you'd like to speak to at some point, because I don't want to pimp my own book. When I was after Molly died, I was asked to write a biography. And I declined, mainly because we had many conversations that I felt were intensely personal, that she would never expect to see in print. And so I said, "No, I can't." And a couple of nights later, I sat bolt upright in bed and thought, "Oh my God, people don't know that Molly was a wonderful cook." And that was what I ended up writing about. An 18-year, almost 20-year friendship that revolved around cooking together. Did you ever talk about food with Molly?
Well, I didn't know Molly.
That's right. You came to her after the fact.
I came after the fact.
After the fact.
But I talk to you about food all the time. but I do know some things because I interviewed Ellen Sweets, And there are stories that are absolutely hilariously rip-roaring funny. And I would like you to share about how you saved a dinner party with Molly Ivins. And this is, of course, before she got sober.
And I made the very unfortunate mistake of attempting to match her drink for drink. Not a wise decision.
If Bob Bullock couldn't, how could you?
Anyway, we were in the kitchen. There were two things that we loved to do. One was grill, and the other was Molly loved gumbo. And so one evening, we were chopping onions because she never believed in using a food processor. It did something to the oils in the onions or some nonsense like that. In any case, there we were chopping up celery, onions, garlic, bell peppers for the roux to make our gumbo. And I looked over and Molly was chopping onions and there was a little red line running through them. And I thought, it's funny, we didn't buy any red onions. I said, Molly, what's with those onions? And she looked up, she said, I'll be goddamn. I cut my finger. I said, Molly, we can't, it's blood in those onions. She put them in a colander and rinsed it out. She said, the heat'll kill whatever was a problem. So then we got that far and we made the roux and we decided that we had had enough to drink that we shouldn't try and cook anymore. And we put it in, put the makings of the roux into the refrigerator, which was already filled with food that people had brought to her as a sort of accommodation to her recovering from surgery. And I said, Molly, this isn't going to fit. And she said, yes, it will. And she shoved the container into the refrigerator on the shelf. And by golly, it did fit. But I said, Molly, tomorrow we got to really remember, because if you open that refrigerator door and don't reach for it, it's going to tumble out. And she said, oh, my, for God's sake, stop being such a fuss budget. I'm not going to forget. So you know what happened. You already know what happened. And so the next day, we're opening the refrigerator to get something out. Out comes the container that has shrimp and crab meat and all of that onion and celery and bell pepper roux that we had made. And Molly says, it's not going to take a minute to make another roux. And she's picking up the shrimp and the crab meat out. And I said, Molly, she said, it's our secret. And if you open your mouth, I'll kill you. I never did. And the really funny thing was that evening when people came to eat, folks were saying, oh, my God, this is the best gumbo you guys have ever made. And I'm thinking, yeah, see what a little dirt and blood will do you?
I love that people told us a lot of stories. So I did learn a lot about Molly, but you asked the one thing that was so amazing. The other thing that I did learn, one thing I will share is that, you know, Molly's papers, everything is housed at the Briscoe. And I got access to everything. And it is a gargantuan task. I got through as much as I could in the amount of time and cost and money. There's one box I'm not allowed in. It's sealed for 75 years after Molly's death. Nobody is allowed in. And I know that it's her sober, it's her writings, it's her journals. She doesn't want to hurt any of her family, so she's making sure that everybody will be pretty much gone before it's allowed to be opened. And I want into those, but I'm not allowed. But the one thing I do have, and here's the thing, is you guys aren't seeing, is I have access to all her diaries, her journals. Molly Ivins knew at a young age that she was going to be famous. She saved everything, including notes that her father left her on the kitchen counter. She still had those. And her relationship with her father was always, you know, that was, it's a lot about that, about male authority figures in her life, that she bucked the system. That's what she said, 35 years of teenage rebellion. So, yes, I have access to a lot. She had diet journals. She had journals, I mean, writings, things, her cancer notes, all of that is going to be, is meticulously going through and will be part of beautiful montages, collages, whatever, to give you a sense of all of who Molly Evans was. But the bigger picture is, as well, is the threat to our beloved democracy that she, every much as she could, every month of the year, even with cancer, she went to every town on behalf of the ACLU and spoke on, you know, the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights, and how to protect those. And so we have one last clip to show. Can we do that?
I just want you to know real quick that Bill D in Longmont was watching, and he has footage of Molly's talks and her procession to court.
Wow.
So
that, thank you, Bill D.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Let's go to the videotape.
I'm apparently up for sale this morning, along with my newspaper, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. As a veteran of this experience, this is my fourth time on the block. I prefer it when the corporate masters announce the results abruptly after the deed is done. That way you don't have time to worry about which Simon Legree might come along and snap you up as a bargain at the price. Could have been worse, we say to one another after the done deal is announced. We could have gone to Rupert Murdoch.
Molly not only had a front row seat to the death of the Democratic Party in the South, she also had a front row seat to the death of print journalism.
So recently you had a newspaper fold.
Yeah.
Is this your fault?
Love Times. They bought it on a Thursday. They got Justice Department approval to kill it on a Friday, and they killed it that Sunday. As my friend Jim Henderson said, sons of bitches, wouldn't you know they'd do this on a day when the liquor stores are closed.
Most of the time between when Molly first started in journalism and where we are today, there has been the corporatization, the politicalization, and the trivialization of news. Entertainment values have virtually overwhelmed news values.
I think probably the greatest threat to freedom of speech today is the concentration of the ownership of media in fewer hands. If you don't have, you know, a billionaire backer, or you aren't owned by a large corporation. I mean, I can tell you that from firsthand experience. It's tough to keep a small, independent, nonprofit media organization going. But we have to do that because we have to have the type of journalism that we do survive, or else we're not going to be talking about the issues that we need to be talking about in the way that we need to be talking about them.
I hear you were deeply depressed at the prospect of having no column to fill. Tell me why is that important?
Well, a steady income is not a bad thing. Something addictive about having a forum in which to sound off.
She was in love with the First Amendment, and she thought free speech was the cornerstone of democracy.
Molly was a renowned around the country. Her columns were in 400 or 500 papers. She gave more ACLU speeches than the president of the ACLU did.
One of her passions was talking about, you know, civil liberties in places where an ACLU card is as good as a Communist Party membership.
A few years ago, we had a classic situation down in Texas. The legislature had taken a fit of communism and voted to make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a state holiday. As you can imagine, it upset the Klan. And, of course, if you are a civil libertarian like myself, you naturally have to stand up for the right of these dim-witted nincompoops to spew whatever vicious drivel they want to, because it's their goddamn right under the First Amendment. Wearing their little pointy hats on their little pointy heads, they were met by several thousand citizens of Austin lining the sidewalks both sides, who mooned them as they marched. It made a real nice effect. It was kind of like a wave at a baseball stadium.
You got to have fun while you're fighting for freedom. For one thing, you don't always win, and that might get to be all the fun you ever have.
Molly would just be appalled that journalism has been reduced to, well, the Republicans say this and the Democrats say that. The unions say this, but the CEO says this. And what's a reader to make of this? Everything's relative, that nothing, there's no truth. Well, journalism is about finding truth.
I'm not against the press, but I am
only against the fake news media or press. Fake. Fake.
There's been a lot of talk in the media about the responsibility to hold Donald Trump accountable. And I'm here to tell you that it goes two ways. We're going to hold the press accountable as well.
Sick and tired of you guys.
The last time I did the same thing, you were the Guardian.
You just body slammed me and broke my glass.
Get the hell out of here.
We've always had attacks on the media. That's kind of just a part of American political life. But for the first time, we have a president and increasingly a political party that treats media, reporters, journalists as sort of an enemy of the country, not just something to critique, but something to defeat.
We are perilously close to taking the most magnificent political legacy any people has ever received and pissing it away.
Politics in this country is not something that is done by them. It's not those people in Washington. It's not those people in your state capital. This country is run by us. It is our deal.
We run this country. We are the board of directors. We own it. They're just the people we have hired to drive the bus for a while.
Democracy depends on the people doing the heavy lifting. And that was her constant message. And I think the lasting lesson we're going to draw.
When Americans really get stirred up, when we stand up on our hind feet and really speak out, they listen to us. Don't forget that. In fact, I'll tell you a secret about politicians. They're scared to death of us. All right, y'all. Use it.
She could have just as easily have been speaking of the times we're now, the interesting times we're now living in.
Without question, that's why this film needs to come out now. We want it done by the end of 2018. It's so important. Her voice is so relevant. And the fact that we're here, it's a sign. I think Molly's doing her bidding up there. She's working. Lots of different things are flowing for us. So there is an urgency to get this finished because she was so prescient. Things she wrote and said 10, 20, 30 years ago are happening. She knew it. And it's amazing to see. I mean, you guys know that.
Well, one of the things, Molly had such a wonderful way with words. And every time I look at one of these dreadful cabinet appointments that have been made under this man-child who pretends to be president, I think of that wonderful quote when she said, if you put his brains in a bee, the bee would fly backwards.
She said that about Dan Quayle. She could say, yeah, well, you could definitely say that about Trump. She would have a field day with Trump. She would eat him for dinner. You know, the thing is that, and we have Rachel Maddow in this too, the thing is, it's so interesting because what Molly did, comedians are doing. You know, everybody says, who's the next Molly Ivins? There is no Molly Ivins. Carr, you want to talk about that as well?
No. All right. Well, we have John Oliver.
But he's a comedian.
He says he's a comedian, but he does a lot of good news work.
So here's the difference. And Rachel Maddow, and this will be in the doc most likely. I mean, look, you saw things that we've used double because we're figuring out the structure and all of that. The comedians, no matter how political, be they Stephen Colbert, John Oliver, Samantha Bee, I mean, there are some really smart people out there. They need still the investigative journalism. They need the truth seekers. Those are journalists in a free and independent press who give them the material so they can do the comedy. Molly did both.
Yeah. And I think she would be heartsick to see what's happening to the Denver Post these days. For a state like Colorado, for a city like Denver to not have a major daily is pretty frightening.
What? Kidding.
Well, you have a hedge fund that has bought the paper, and the rumor is that the first chance they get, they're going to unload it. And right now, there is no major corporate entity that's picking up the sale. So it's a little scary. And I think that, I don't know, maybe you two would like to talk a little bit about the importance of maintaining a free and open press and how it relates to what you're doing.
Well, coming in Houston, we have a pretty good free and open press. There are people that are writing for the Daily Chronicle, for our Chronicle, that we are covering both the left and the right, if you want to polarize it as that. I will say this, though, that one of the people that you saw in the alcohol clips of Molly, she and Molly and another friend of theirs, and they were childhood friends, they marched themselves down to the editorial desk of the Houston Chronicle and complained, or actually Molly wasn't with this. There were two friends of Molly's, and they complained to the editorial desk and said, "Why aren't you carrying Molly? She is a hometown hero." So the Houston Chronicle at the time refused to carry Molly's syndicated columns. Now we have a different editor now, but this is what happened to Molly over the course of her years when she lived in Austin, and she was a columnist. She was syndicated in over 400 papers, but there were many towns that would not carry her.
Yeah, and censorship.
Yeah, the censorship. She was also nominated for 3 Pulitzers, but she never won because of the censorship issue.
Well, we believe that. We don't know for sure, but okay. That's, you know, our sense is that, you know, it's the corporate master. She pissed somebody off, you know. But I do think there is, so like I said earlier, we don't want this just to be a biopic. This is a much bigger picture. We have a real threat that we are facing, and I think all y'all know that. And so we want this documentary to be a clarion call. That's what Molly would want. To wake people up and take back what is rightfully ours, which means getting out there and getting people to vote. And following, and it's about the people coming up. I'm a boomer, you know, it's moving past us. The Parkland kids, it's not a moment, it's a movement. She would have loved what they're doing. So we need to support our younger generations and really get out there. They're fired up. And the only way it's going to change if it comes from we the people. That is what she would say. So this is, I believe, a much bigger issue than just a biopicture about Molly Ivins. It's about everything she stood for and what she held. And until her dying day, what she preached.
Well, apropos to that, this question, is Election Day way too crazy a goal to have the documentary available?
Someone got $350,000 to give me right now.
Go, Carr. Okay, now I'm going to step in as the fiscal producer of the documentary, not just the person who has to talk Janice off the ledge when I get this phone call that says, "Carr, I don't have a creative bone in my body, and I don't know why I'm doing this documentary. It really sucks," and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, so I talk Janice off the ledge. So a producer does a variety of things. But right now, I'm going to do this. So anybody associated with the CWA, close your ears, because I'm not supposed to do this. Come see me afterwards if you would like to help us get to our $350,000 goal, because I will hand you something that you can then talk back to me in any form of donation you want to. Okay, now I've said that.
And spread the word.
And that's why I said, please tell all your friends and the kids and your life and direct them to our website, because there's some funny clips on the website, y'all, that maybe the younger people in your life, you think they would really benefit seeing.
www.mollyivinsfilm.com. We're also on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Molly Ivins Film is the moniker. You can just Google Raise Hell. It'll come up. It's also, you should know, any donation is tax deductible. We are fiscally sponsored by the International Documentary Association.
Well, apparently we have a little good news here. It says someone has sent us a note saying that a Colorado investor group has anteed up $10 million as a part of a community effort to buy the Denver Post. So maybe things aren't as dire as they seem.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Colorado Springs based Resurrect the Post looking for investors.
So are we.
The important thing, I think, for everyone to remember is that you don't have to give $100. You don't have to give $1,000. If you can give $10, if you can give $15, if you can give $25. And I know everybody and his mother is looking for money these days. But we're in, I think, a period, if I can proselytize for a minute, I think we're in a period where we have to understand the importance of sacrificing a little bit to achieve what we know needs to happen going forward.
Yes.
Have we exhausted our time yet, or do we have more time for a little bit more?
We've got about 10 minutes.
We have 10 minutes. Anyone else? Anyone else we want to hear from? Anything else you'd like to add to? I hope you noticed that to validate her presence here as a Texan, Carlisle is wearing her cowboy boots.
I realize no self-respecting Texan could come to Colorado and talk about Molly Ivins without wearing a pair of cowboy boots.
Okay. Is there anybody have any more questions from the audience? I know you guys filled out cards, but can we just take questions, like free form? Is that okay?
Go for it.
Do we have anyone?
We don't have a mic there, but maybe nobody can talk loud.
Do we have anyone who'd like to raise a question? I saw a hand.
Yeah, there's.
Yeah,
we can share.
I don't need a mic.
Yeah, people in the back can't hear you.
I want to know why Trump is still in office. It is beyond my comprehension and the comprehension of everyone I know. Can anybody explain it to me?
Let it rip, Ellen.
I was on a panel earlier this week, and I think the title was From Apprentice to Outsider, and it was essentially about Trump's elevation to the office of the president. And a man came up afterwards and he said, I just wanted to tell you that I voted both times for Obama, but this last time I voted for Trump. And I tried to maintain my calm. I tried not to go, what? And I said, help me understand the logic behind your decision making. And he said, well, I just thought Trump was going to deliver on his promises. And I said, did you not read anything about his background, how he stiffed his employers, how he treated his tenants when he wanted to convert apartment buildings to condominiums? Had you not seen that dreadful clip of him wrestling some guy to the ground in the World Wrestling Federation nonsense? And he said, well, yeah. And I said, okay, because I kept waiting for something that resembled a reasoned response, and it never came. And I'm still just left in the back of my little pea brain thinking, this is not somebody who said, okay, we've had enough of the black guy as president. Let's go to the crazy white guy at the other end of the spectrum. But it wasn't that. I don't have an answer. I don't even know if there is an answer. It's just too strange.
Somebody behind you. Oh, somebody's got, okay,
great. Yes, I'd like to know that when you were beginning this project, what were the three most important people/roles who you brought into the project that helped make it successful?
Well, definitely my producing partners, for sure. Betsy Moon, who opened the door for us without question. And let me think about that a second. Who would be the next one? The three most important people.
Lou?
Yeah, well, Lou DeBose was actually our first interview. He was my very first interview. And he's so lovely and so open, and he's such a great storyteller. You know, it was a collection of people. It was my producing partners. It was Betsy to get us through. And then I would say it was Molly's initial people, posse, who welcomed us with such love and open arms. And were so excited that we wanted to do this. So it wasn't... go ahead, Carl.
I will also say that when we were shooting in Austin and I was calling around to get equipment and deals, we would hear from people, oh, you're doing a doc on Molly? We're going to give you the family and friends rate. I mean, all through this process, people have given us incredible rates on rooms, on equipment, whatever we needed. We've gotten, people have not billed us, they've not charged us for their time, or they've given us an incredibly low family and friends rate. It's been fantastic.
They've offered to put me up, and when I would come into Austin and I'd have to spend like a month and change, maybe more, they would offer to put me up. You know, it's been an outpouring. It's a community. Yeah. Molly built a community, but she also built a constituency. And we get all the time on Facebook with over 18,000 followers, we get, you know, how much everybody misses her. She really struck a chord that hasn't died but is growing. And I will tell you this. I teach documentary film and other things at Academy of Art University in San Francisco, which I love teaching. And I showed this to my Documentary 1 class, my sizzle, because it's 6.5 minutes long, because, you know, attention spans. And for them, I thought, oh, this is going to be too long. And they were, the lights went, was done, the lights went up, and I didn't even miss a beat, because I just said, too long, right? They said, no, who is she? She's hilarious. Can we go see her? I kid you not. In San Francisco, and they were blown away. So there is an audience out there of young people, and we actually do have a thing where we did bring in some young journalists and about who's the next crop, because there's no new Molly Ivins, but it's a brigade. It's a young group of journalists and activists on the front lines who are doing all of what she did as one person, but they're doing it, and their hearts are in the right place.
I have a question here about distribution plans. Once this is completed, is it just for us, the converts, or is it going to go beyond preaching to the choir?
Well, we will, when at the end of May, we'll have a fine rough cut. And so the finishing funds are to make the graphics package work and to make Molly look one skin tone. It's versus the 5 or 6 you saw in the clips today. And so, but with the rough cut, we will then start talking to people like Showtime and PBS that have said to us, oh, we're interested, but we need to see a fine rough cut because we need to see that you all actually have a story there. So the answer to the distribution question, we don't know, but we would like to get it to somebody that is screening on multimedia platforms. Is that what we call that? Yeah.
We also, we're going to take it to the platform of networks and entities like that. There are people very interested who have been waiting for a rough cut. Then HBO, Showtime, Netflix, Amazon. There's a whole array out there. The other thing is getting it into film festivals, which we would love to be able to hold on to it. Sundance, South by Southwest. I'd love it to be in Molly's stomping grounds. I would love it to be at Sundance. I think it's a no-brainer that it will get onto a platform that will be able to be streamed. I mean, yes, we'd like to have a theatrical release because that's, as a filmmaker, I would love that. But more people will see it on streaming and television. Many more people do that, and we want to get it out to as many people. The other thing we do is we really want this to have an educational component, so we really want it to be multi-platformed. You know, we want to talk to educational outlets, you know, and so it's each step, it's coming. We have seen that. It's coming.
We have time for one more quick question because, as we used to say, we're down to stems and seeds here. So let's... Yes.
It was good to see the people from the Texas Observer, where she worked, to Mother Jones, where she was a contributor. Can you guys talk for a little about the importance of independent journalism to Molly and what the media landscape meant to her?
Can you say that again?
What independent journalism meant to Molly?
Oh, well, Molly was a columnist and she was independent. She was syndicated in over 400 newspapers. I mean, when you are independent, you are not you don't have to bow down to the corporate master. Yes. So we have a whole thing that we're going to be doing in the documentary. Molly had a big thing about, do you play an inside game or an outside game? What do you think Molly played? She was an outsider. And she chose to be an outsider because she used to have arguments with Dan Rather about this. And we have a whole thing about with Dan Rather, Rachel Maddow, all talking about this, Paul Krugman. Molly played an outside game because, as she loved to say, access is overrated. So she knew. And she at times did get caught up. Ronnie Duggar said she got too close to the Clintons. You know, and we have footage, really interesting footage that nobody's ever seen of Molly being totally angry at Bill Clinton. Like, I mean, oh... A Molly you've never seen. You know she didn't vote in the second Clinton run? She didn't vote. She was disgusted because of what he did with the Welfare Act. And she said, it makes me want to vomit. She was disgusted. And she takes him out. You know, that said, you know, Molly, she, independent free press, that, Jesus, she wrote for so many. I mean, Ellen, you can, how many podunk independent papers did she write for?
Mike. She was beloved over in Jefferson County in Texas, which is about as red and rednecky as you could get at the time. But they knew her, and Molly would go, excuse me, Molly would go to an ACLU meeting and speak for free if there were 3,000 people in the audience. I have to tell you that we really are running out of time, and I've been asked to remind you of the Science March tomorrow, 10 a.m. in Denver. I hope it's warmer. I hope you all show up.
I want to thank everybody for your patience, for coming, showing up, and seeing what we're doing. And get out there and raise hell.
Thank you so much for being here.